Welcome to the Pirates Overboard podcast. I'm your host, Justin Ostwick, joined alongside Jonathan Luters. We are two grad student athletes that will sit down with Seton Hall athletes to get to know them more on a personal level. We're going to talk to them about their athletic career, academic goals, and what it's like being a part of the Seton Hall community. We are excited to do this across the year as we touch into each sports community. Make sure you go follow us on the Pirates Overboard Instagram page to get the latest news on upcoming guests and highlights from shows previously. So Jonathan, who are we talking to today?
Gregory Tate is our next guest on the alumni series. Tate was a standout golfer for the Pirates men's golf team and had a stellar golfing career. His final year was one to remember, where he was named the SHU Senior Male Co-Athlete of the Year, led the Pirates and ranked third in the Big East with a career best 71.68 scoring average, collected two top five finishes and five top 10 efforts, recorded a remarkable 17 subpar rounds and four subpar tournaments. He leaves Seton Hall ranked fourth all time with a 73.71 career scoring average, second with 31 subpar rounds, and tied for third with eight subpar tournaments. No golfer in Seton Hall history has played more than Tate's 130 rounds. To top all things off, he led the golf team to their first Big East championship since 2000. In this episode, you'll hear about his experiences golfing at SHU, what he learned, insight and advice to current and future Pirates, and why they call him the closer. Current head coach and former podcast guest, JT Harper, calls Gregor one of the most impressive leaders he's ever been around. And we are stoked to have Gregor on board with us today. So without further ado, Gregor Tate.
Welcome, Gregor Tate, from across the pond. And we're all over the place today, boys. Jonathan Luters up in Massachusetts, where it's currently snowing. I'm down in Clearwater, Florida, on training trip. And our guest, Gregor Tate, who is an alumni here for the Seton Hall golf team, he's over across the pond in England. So first thing first, Gregor, how are you doing today?
I'm very well. I'm just in kind of prepping a few things. I'm heading to South Africa next weekend. I've got a month out there playing four different events. So it's kind of just getting everything in order and polishing up a few things on my game. And then, get on the plane and get busy. It's always a slightly strange one going from a British climate to an African one overnight. So I'm sure I'll cook for the first 3 days and adjust and carry on. But I'm really looking forward to it. So, yeah, I'm very well. Thank you for having me on.
Of course. Thank you for popping on for us. Make sure you bring your sunscreen now. We don't need to burn too much now. You got to play some really good golf. So what have you been up to the past couple months? And you were telling us just before, it's kind of raining right now in England constantly, it seemed like you were saying. Yeah. So kind of what have you been up to kind of prepping for those tournaments down in South Africa?
Zooming out a little more than just the last couple months, because the last couple months I've actually had a little bit of time off, has been really, really nice. So I played a really long season last season because it was a Walker Cup year. So when you're trying to be selected for the Walker Cup, you kind of have to play every event that you can get your hands on. So my season had started, I started off in kind of the middle of November in the US and played all the way through until the middle of October. So most golfers and most full-time guys will tell you that 11 straight months with next to no breaks is a heavy shift. So I really enjoyed having a little time off and came home. I had options to go somewhere warm and train for the winter, but I actually felt like a bit of a reset and coming home and just kind of, I was a little beat. My body was a little beaten up and mentally was definitely drained. Just having some time at home has been great. The weather is far from ideal, but you kind of have to get out there when you get the available, when you get a slot here and there, that it's really nice to get out. And I'm fortunate that my home course over here, Aldbrough Golf Club, is right on the coast, so it doesn't really freeze. The salty air kind of keeps it above, keeps the ground temperatures up enough to where they can keep the course in good shape. So it's a little miserable, but I have a facility to get done what I need to do.
Awesome. So what is that like? You said you had some off. off time right now, what does your like off season training look like? I know you say you get on the course and whatnot. Is that just more by yourself with other guys, weightlifting, like all that stuff? What does that really look like?
Yeah, I mean, I'm predominantly alone. You know, there's a couple guys around where I live who play full time, but you know, I'm quite a selfish practicer. I like to be by myself and doing what I like to do. I find practicing with somebody can be a little distracting at times. Like, you know, I just like to start chatting about anything and everything, focus goes so quickly. So I also like the sort of, you know, mental grind of it, because sometimes, you know, you guys know, you know, practice isn't always easy, and especially mechanical practice. Like if you're trying to change something, you know, you very often hit the ball terribly before you hit it good. If you're, you know, I don't want to drag anybody else's mood down when I'm standing in a cold field, absolutely miserable the whole time. So, Team Scotland put me into their sort of sports institute, which is like a overarching organization that look after, you know, all of their high level athletes. So a little bit of everything. And, they gave you like a weightlifting program and they kind of guide you through. And I had a guy, brilliant, Chris Robinson, look after me. And he kind of, you know, golf's a funny one because, you know, you can look at any level of golf and there is every single shape, size, you know, athletic ability doesn't seem to really pay too much into what the outcome is. But I mean, it is trending in a direction where guys are getting stronger and guys are getting taller and hitting the ball further and further and further. So you can't neglect it anymore. A lot of people used to kind of just, you know, it was, you know, I mean, John Daly's your prime example, right? Like you had Tiger Woods, who's out there, you know, at the crack of dawn running 8 miles and lifting 1,000 weights and practicing all day. And then you had John Daly, who's just on the biz all day. And they didn't seem to correlate whatsoever at their success rates. But they, you know, definitely the Tiger changed the game in that sense. And, you know, you speak to anybody and everybody who's playing to a good level, they've got some sort of an exercise program. So that keeps me a little busy. And then I had a guy, there's a guy in who lives locally, Scottish guy, and he's got a indoor studio that's built into the back of his garden. So he's been an absolute lifesaver, being able to go in there when the weather is miserable. I mean, it's like having the golf room. You guys have seen the golf room at Seton Hall. Yeah, you know, man. It's like having that, and having access to that technology is huge as well. So that, and then I suppose I then sprinkle in a few lessons with my swing coach and my putting coach every now and again. So it is off season, but it's still busy. You know, keeps me ticking over. But I think it's the break from competition really that serves as like the reset and the recharge. Because, you know, you guys know how stressful it is playing any sort of competition. You know, when you have that competitive edge, you want to win. So when you want to win and you don't win, the outcome's difficult. And having some time off has been great. I've really enjoyed it, but I've kept myself busy, and I'd like to think I'm still getting better even through the quiet months.
Yeah, so absolutely. Busy man you are, and Jonathan's going to get the opportunity to play on the simulator, according to Coach Harper. He mentioned that in his episode with the protein balls, or the protein peanut butter balls. Someone's excited, yes. I cannot swing a golf club for my life, so I'm going to stay away from the simulator to save myself from some embarrassment, we'll say. So you talked about competition, and you had an amazing career here at Seton Hall. So first things first, as we talk about Seton Hall, what went into that decision to come back and play for your fifth year right after COVID? Like we've talked about it a couple times on our show, where that COVID year was a crazy year for any student athlete, for any student to begin with, because of classes and how we competed as a school and as a conference. So what went into that decision to come back for that fifth year?
I'm sure Andres and I, you know, we were never more than about 3 feet from each other for our entire time. So, it was a very easy decision for us. We, you know, we hadn't won a Big East championship, and we'd sat there as freshmen and said that we were going to be the people who were going to get that done. And, you know, I had seen what recruits were going to come in and what we were going to have coming in and joining us, and I was pretty excited. Knew that it was, we were maybe going to get a couple of pieces that we potentially didn't have before. And I won't name him, but we had an academically ineligible player for that COVID year. Mm. And having him back was massive. So it just kind of felt right, especially for myself. You know, I had an extra year on my visa, and it would have felt like a massive waste to have left after 4 years when I had the opportunity to come back and play again. And I mean, you guys know, you've been through the system enough now. What, it gets easier. You learn what's going to come when it's going to be hard, and when you're going to have to do this and do that. And, you know, Coach White was so supportive of Andres and I, and we, you know, having the fifth year sort of, you know, the classes take a little bit more of a backseat, and have, you know, COVID, we were just fresh out of COVID. So online study was a major thing. So we were able to get out of New Jersey a fair bit, and we were down in San Antonio, Andres's place. And, you know, we transitioned from student athletes into full-time athletes in that fifth year.
Nice.
The product of that was a Big East championship at the end of it. So it was a very, very easy decision. And Coach White was, you know, more than happy, because at that point, it's like, if you have the opportunity to take some recruitment money and go out and find a high school kid who may well be a really good golfer, but you don't know, right? It's always a gamble. You never know whether a recruit is going to, you know, excel or have, you know, trouble when they come to the school. So when you can retain your number one and number two player on the team, it's like, you'd be crazy not to, almost. And we really felt like we were going to have enough pieces to get over the line in that Big East. Because we, you know, we went to just my COVID year, that's my senior year. The Big East Championship was like, we felt like we were fully confident we were going to get it done that year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sport is how sport is. It doesn't always work out like that. And I think if you spoke to everybody who was a part of both of those teams, they'll be able to tell you that there was things we did the year before that we didn't, that, you know, we learned from and then took to that fifth year conference championship.
Yeah, kind of talk to us about what that team environment was like during that fifth year, and like how you guys all really locked in and said, hey, this is the team goal. We're going to get this. Like what did that process look like for you guys?
Yeah, I think, I mean, full transparency, you know, the team culture at times it wasn't brilliant. Andres was really, really good at sort of people management and seeing things from other people's, you know, through other people's eyes. And he was very relatable to all the guys, whereas I would definitely, and they'll all tell you, you know, I was definitely the bad guy in quite a few of the situations, because I didn't, you know, I knew what I wanted, and I knew what I wanted, and I knew how we were going to get it done, and we both did. And I just had no, you know, I was a grumpy fifth year old man senior. Like I wouldn't have the patience to be with everybody. So, when we got into the springtime, there was, you know, a very, very clear, you know, a few, you know, the core of the team was very, very obvious about what we were trying to accomplish. And, you know, we made sacrifices to get what we got. And, you know, I couldn't have asked any more from any of the guys, really. You know, they bought into what we were trying to do. And it was just a beautiful culmination of so many things that came together for it to, you know, get over the line. But the team culture wasn't, you know, I think good team culture doesn't always mean everybody's happy all the time and everybody's, you know, it's all positive this and positive that. That's not how it goes. You know, you have to have the hard conversations, and sometimes you have to really get stuck into a guy. If they're out of line, or if you're out of line, you need someone to get stuck into you. And I think the leadership of the team being two, three guys, because I'd put Devin in there as well, because he was the senior and he'd been through it with Andres and I the whole time as well. And having more than one leader, I think, on the team was good, because you know, nobody's perfect. So like we would go out of line too, and having somebody else who was, you know, part of that leadership group who could kind of scruff you the neck and be like, what's going on, man? Like, you know, wake up. It made things a lot easier. And sharing the load, I guess, would be probably the way I'd describe it. And I mean, it came good in the end. but I wouldn't change it. It was a wild ride, but I wouldn't change it whatsoever. Wouldn't change it at all.
Man, yeah, a wild ride from the outside looking in. I can't imagine from like the inside out, like all the different dynamics and pieces. And you touched upon in a lot of ways how shout out to Devin and Dre for what they did as well. And obviously give yourself a lot of credit, but it's cool that you touched upon how there's different styles of leading, and especially with the guys you had coming in. Like you had to say, like, hey, they probably had no idea what it was like to be a college athlete or just a college golfer in specific, but like also like a college athlete. And you're like, hey, like, this is what we want. And you knew, I mean, we can tell from the passion you're speaking about, you knew what you wanted and you knew what you were capable of. And you wanted that for the younger guys. But it was also maybe taking like Dre or Devin to come out in a different light, and be like, hey, like, whoa, like you're super intense, super passionate. There might be need to come out a different way. I have no idea. I'm just speculating. But the fact that you were able to be so self-aware in that aspect is awesome. And probably was a huge reason why the culture was it was at the end of the year. And you, as you said, it wasn't perfect, but you kind of got through to everyone and it came through at the right time and the right moment. And here we are, Big East Championship Golf Team. Not bad.
Yeah. It's kind of hard. Like you can't put like your finger on one single thing that we did or one particular value that we had that transpired in us winning a championship. But, you know, it definitely, the accountability was massive on our team. Mm. That was something we talked about all the time. And you know, Coach White is, you know, the military background, like he is that, you know, he stands for integrity and accountability and honesty. And that was paramount to him. And he, you know, in that fifth year, it was really interesting because like it felt like we were like a leadership team. Like it didn't feel like it was like coach and player or captain and player or freshman and senior. Like we were a true team. Like everyone contributed, everyone put their sense into the hat. Like it, you know, it was, we didn't really go around saying you must do this and you must do that. It was like you try and, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an age old cliche, but it's relevant. And I think especially for Angus and Josh coming in as freshmen, I mean, coming into college sport during that coronavirus time was unbelievably difficult. I mean, shout out Wanksy and Brody as well. Like they came, they arrived to Seton Hall and, you know, it wasn't until the end of the year, like we played a Big East Championship and they were meeting people in their grade for the first time.
Wow.
Like, it's just so different to what we went through. So, I mean, huge for those guys to be able to, you know, manage that and manage all the difficulties of the rest of the world was thrown at them. And then you had Andrew and I and Devin harping on them to practice and be disciplined and all of this. So, I would almost credit the younger guys on the team as much as what we did for, you know, taking it in their stride and, you know, no one made a huge problem and was really difficult. It was like, they could see, I think, you know, it's the passion, like they could see how passionate we were about what we wanted to achieve and no one's ego was big enough to stand in the way of that.
That's awesome. It really sounds, I mean, it's going to sound cliche, but like a real team effort. I know you were just touched upon that. And you said the word about accountability and how you all held each other accountable, younger guys, older guys, young guys alike. And you mentioned before about how you guys made sacrifices to get where you wanted to go. I know a lot of teams talk about making sacrifices and decisions. I don't want to go too far into like a rabbit hole here. We want to get into like things after Seton Hall as well.
Yeah.
What were do you remember some of the sacrifices or decisions that you guys made as a team or individually that helped you become better version of yourselves and ultimately lead to a championship level team?
Yeah, I think, you know, no student is perfect. You know, you're only a text away from going out and partying your whole week away if you want to. And definitely in terms of, you know, the discipline in practice was really, really good. But also I'd have said something that we did really well was we competed against one another and we would go out to practice and, you know, guys with scoring averages who wouldn't even come close to myself or Andres would step up and say, I want to play against you today. And, you know, I want to challenge you today. And I think that's a really, really healthy thing for a team when the guys who are maybe not going to play and maybe not going to, you know, might not even touch the grass at the Big East Championship are still pushing you and still expecting, you know, because if you're not willing to do it and they are, then why, just because you're a better player, why would they, you know, if you're lazy and you don't do, you know, you don't do the things that you need to do, then why would you, would you really want that, you know, coming down the stretch of a Big East championship? If you're not a polished player and you don't have the reps in that you need, then you're gonna crumble under the pressure at the very end. And I would rather have somebody who's worked and knows a game and is maybe their potential score isn't as good as somebody else. But if you've got, you know, hard work beats talent and talent doesn't work hard, you know, we'll keep dropping cliches this whole podcast. I'll keep sliding them in as often as I can. It was a really, you know, the sacrifices, they come from, you know, the minute you wake up to the minute you go to bed. And it sounds like it's, you know, huge things that we did, but it's just little decisions, you know, making smart decisions here and making smart decisions there. And as long as you prioritize the right things, I think that is the sacrifices that you make. You know, you can, and guys did what they needed to do to make themselves ready for the Big East. And there was, you know, especially, you know, of the core of that team put in an unbelievable amount of hours of practice in that spring semester. And it showed, you know, like we were rattling off wins and, you know, we should have picked up two more wins than we did as well in that season. And I think winning is hard, but maintaining a winning streak is really difficult. But it spirals on itself, you know, it snowballs. And once you have that taste of success, it's much easier to say no to going out and wasting your time when you've got another one coming. So I guess it kind of snowballed itself. And you know, by the end, it was like, you know, I've always kind of enjoyed the practice side of things. But it was so nice to, you know, you'd go up to the golf room at a silly time during the day and you'd expect to see nobody there. And there's three guys there, you know, mm-hmm. and there's, it's like my goodness, they've beaten me there. Not only have they beaten me there, they've been practicing for an hour already. So, you know, it keeps you going as well. And I was, couldn't be more proud to have been a part of that group of guys. It was a really tight knit group. You know, we had some troubles and some difficulties and some bad things happen, but the way we were able to deal with it, and, you know, every it almost felt like every problem that was thrown kind of brought people a bit closer together.
Amazing. And we have to touch on one more thing about your Seton Hall career. And you talked about pressure, and I'm going to bring it up. I don't know if you remember, way back in 2022, right after you won, me and you sat down and did a little profile piece. Yes. And I dug it up. I found it. I've dug it up. And you said, I do not shy away from the moment and accept that pressure because it makes me understand and appreciate where I am on the golf course, which makes me makes me play better. So we can't go without touching upon the Caleb Manuel story. You were going back and forth with him, and you ended up conceding your Big East individual title to give him a chance to play an NCAA regional. So we've heard Brian Felt talk about it. We've heard about Coach Harper talk about it. So kind of talk your way through that situation from your perspective, and just tell us what your feelings and thoughts during that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a funny one. It's a funny one, really. Like when I look back at it, because it was, you know, the elation of what we had just achieved and what we had just accomplished, it would have been, you know, pretty easy to run away from it and you know, not be too, you know. But actually, when you look at I had to do some fair, you know, questioning and asking the right people, but we were, the regardless of the outcome of the playoff, we were co-champions for the individual side because it's the Big East team championship, right? Like the individual thing is like that's you know, second to what you're really trying to do there. And so if you ask me, to go, given we were named co-champions, to go down when the only thing that was on the line in the playoff was a spot, was his potential going to regionals, it would be wrong to play that playoff. Like you're going to be co-champions regardless, right? And that you know, the press will say that he won the tournament, but that doesn't bother me. Like, you know, it's not, you know, I went there to win a Big East championship with my team. I was never there to win an individual title, as much as I would love to. And you know, it's the kind of thing that it stays with you forever. The to take the opportunity away from somebody else would just be wrong. And I think this also gets left out of this story quite a lot. Caleb was I'd said Caleb was the best player in the conference that year. And they put him in the second team, All Big East second team, which was just criminal.
Wow.
Criminal decision. So I said before the tournament started, and a few of us did. I remember sitting in the houses in Georgia chatting away, and we were all expecting him to just go run away. Because like, you light a fire under the guy like that, he's just gonna run away. And you know, we spoke afterwards, and he's had a frustrating day on the final day. But I think if it was the other way around, I think he would do exactly the same thing that I did, and I would go back, I would do the same thing over and over and over again. And yes, it was, you know, the reaction that I got after it happened said to me that I did the right thing, you know. I only had a person or two here and there be like, what were you thinking? You could have won la-di-da-di-da. But it's like, no, we were co-champions. Like, even when you look on the, you know, the world ranking points and everything, is T1. It's never, you know, him one and me two. Like, it's T1 for both of us. And yeah, I would have had it, you know, it wouldn't have sat right with me to have gone and played a playoff when the only thing on the line was to take the opportunity away from somebody else. So like, it almost would be selfish, I'd have said, to find pleasure in removing opportunity from somebody else. And you know, it, take nothing away from it, if the team had finished fourth, I would have gone down there and done absolutely everything in my power to win that playoff. But that wasn't what happened, you know? Like, right. We already had our tickets booked to the NCAA. Yeah, it was a very cool experience. And I think, you know, even the UConn coach, you know, came and, you know, I won't share what he said, but, you know, he said some really special things to me after I did it. And even, you know, I mean, John Fanta, you guys know John, and he was,
of course,
you know, he was pretty moved by what happened. And then for Brian, I mean, even Brian Felt to say something, and when he was chatting to you guys about it, and you know, he ranks it so highly in his experiences as an AD. I mean, that's the honor in it for me. And I would do exactly the same thing 1,000 times over.
It's such a cool moment, not only for Seton Hall golf or Seton Hall, but just for golf in general, because that moment was like on all golf like networks. I'm pretty sure, I don't know, like Golf Channel or whatnot, but it wasn't just about Seton Hall. It was way bigger than that moment. Mm. And for you to be so gracious in that moment, and you don't see it as that, just more like the right thing to do. But man, like what an impact it had on way beyond just that one moment. It rippled all the way out to the golf world. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are looking up to you and looking, not as like, okay, like sure, like you have these professional golfers and all that, but I don't think any professional golfers have done anything like that before. So I think it was a really, really cool moment. So huge props to you again, as you've
Thank you. Shout out Matt Sweeney for getting the story to pedal into the right channels as well, because he made a couple of really, really savvy moves to get the story into the right place. And you know, eventually, as soon as Golf Channel grabbed it, it just went nuts. Like it was all over the place. So that was probably the most nervous I've ever been, was speaking on live on the Golf Channel. You know, you give me 10 feet in front of thousands of people for a golf tournament, I'm fine. But you stick me on the national TV, I'm all over the place. But yeah, it was really, really cool reaction. And you know, I think moments where the sport kind of takes the backseat and you see good morals and good ethics come through, it makes everybody feel good. You know, you don't have to be a sports fan to like that. So, but thank you. I appreciate calm words.
No, of course. It's true.
Of course. So let's move into more of your pro career now. Now, you were describing as before, you're still on your amateur status. So explain to everyone listening that whole process. I know I got to work with actually the Golf Channel on SiriusXM this past summer, so I kind of know a little bit of the ins and outs, but describe to kind of like what your career path has so far looked like coming out of school.
Yeah, so I always wanted to play for Scotland. I always wanted to represent my country. Like, that was something that I, you know, prioritized even while I was at Seton Hall, you know, because we played tournaments during the summer, and you know, you have a golf life outside of college golf as well. Mm-hmm. And when I finished, I thought, you know, I'm going to play out the rest of the summertime and just enjoy my game. And because I wasn't 100% sure if I was going to keep playing or what I was going to do. And then, you know, my numbers and my averages and my statistics started looking like, okay, you should probably keep going when you get done with college. So I carried on playing, and then it kind of got to sort of September, October time, and I won a real big tournament down in over here. And I thought, you guys know the Walker Cup, which is mm-hmm. the, you know, your top 10 US guys against your top 10 GB guys. And it was a year out. So it was like, do I turn professional and, you know, start my professional journey, or do I kind of hang on and see whether I can, you know, make this team? And at the time I was, you know, probably pretty far outside of even being considered, but I put together a plan and you know, what I was going to need to do and how many world ranking points I was going to need to scoop if I was going to be even get close. And I had some help from some alumni through Seton Hall, who were massive in their support for getting me out to these events and getting me, you know, all over the world. You know, I did America and Australia and South Africa and all over Europe, and then back to the US again, and you know, a massive, massive haul, this crazy long season, which I touched on earlier on. And I missed out on this team. And it probably came down to, so I lost in the final of the Scottish Amateur to a lad who plays his golf at Northwestern. So Cammy, if you're listening, I blame you for it. He played amazing, but my season had been sort of very mediocre. You know, I would make a lot of cuts, and then I would sort of, you know, I wouldn't really compete or contend. Like I was really good at making cuts, but I was never turning those cuts into contention and really getting involved in the tournaments and the last nine holes. And I had, you know, a couple heartbreaking second place finishes. I had the Master of the Amateurs, so which is, you know, one of the top tournaments on planet Earth. It's actually starts in a couple of days' time, is down in Australia, and I got into a real duel with John Goff, who was a, you know, top 10 player in the world at the time, and we had a really good battle. And he pipped me just in the last few holes, but I was like, okay, well, I can hang with that guy. And I hadn't really felt like I'd really kicked into like top gear yet. So I know I've got the firepower, but just results went a certain way, and I missed a cut, you know, one or two cuts at the wrong time. But I never at any point did I think I'm going to wander away from this, turn pro and start something else. Like I wanted to see it all the way through. And missed out eventually, probably by, you know, three or four spots. You know, I needed a win, and so mm-hmm. coming up short in the final of the Scottish Am was, you know, having one hand on that trophy. And I'd actually done the same thing the year before. So the Scottish Amateur, it's match play form. So you make your cut, and then you play 64 plays one, 63 plays two, all the way down to the final. And I'd lost in the final the previous year to a lad who's going to go and play his golf at Duke, and then I get all the way back through to the final again, and the guy who beat me played out of his mind all week. And it was always kind of always going to be his tournament that week. So that, I think, that emotional like release, and Alex Chalk, who played his golf at Seton Hall, he was caddying for me, and I mean, there was just a moment where just the exhaustion and the emotion and the kind of realization that this like year-long goal that I'd been shooting for wasn't going to come in. And I then had sort of almost an instant drop off in my performance, and played kind of mediocre golf for the rest of the year. And then so now I've kind of completed that amateur season, and I've kept my amateur status just because I'm not 100% sure when I'm going to turn pro. I will turn pro at some point, but you need the right things in place. You need some sponsors, and you need, you know, I always kind of said I wouldn't turn professional unless I had a card on some tour, but it's that's a really difficult thing to do, is to just get a card. So I'm speaking with, you know, my coach and my family and you know, some potential sponsors about where I'm going to do and what I'm going to, how I'm going to set myself up and where I'm going to play my golf. So I think 2024 will be the year to turn pro, but I've absolutely loved my experience in the amateur game. And you know, when you get up to the top of the amateur game, it's a really glamorous life that you can lead. You know, you play the best courses, you have people who look after you, you know, comprehensively. And yeah, I'm so glad that I carried on playing post-college, really. And really glad that I stayed amateur and have had some amazing experiences. And now I'm, you know, going to turn pro and be right back at the bottom of the mountain, looking up, ready to start climbing again. You know? So it's going to be good fun.
It's really cool that you broke it down, like what you need to do by the end of the year to make your end goal of making the team. And man, like a lot of respect for you, for obviously you fell short by one place, second place by one place twice. And, kind of had the resilience and again, like the self-awareness to kind of take a step back. But man, I've had some great experiences. I've learned so much. I've met some awesome people, played the best courses and all that. And here we go. I'm going to look forward to turning pro in 2024 and kind of take the world by storm. So man, like it's not an easy thing. And I mean, here I am. Like I need to do the best job I can myself and take notes from you, even Gregor here, to like take the, not the losses, but just take the experience you had and just learn from it. And be like, man, I'm going to have the best year moving forward and all that. So again, huge props to you and thanks for sharing all of this with us. It's really, really cool.
Of course. Yeah. I think, I mean, the, you know, being results, being, you know, letting results define how you see things can get you kind of out of sync pretty quickly. I think, you know, if you zoom out on things and, you know, your objective goal is just to get as good as you possibly can, then everything's almost a stepping stone, you know? And I think I made the mistake in the kind of Walker Cup chase to that. I was, you know, I was like, I need a win. I have to win. I have to do this. I have to finish at this. I have to finish in the top 10, or I have to finish at this point or at that point. And you go, so you zoom in so much and you go so week to week and round to round and shot to shot that you actually forget that, you know, there's long-term things going on too. And there's things you need to change. And there's, you know, that, they're so easy to get wrapped up and so narrow. I think, you know, compared to, you know, actually really interesting example at the moment is Cade Cunningham, right? So he's playing on the Pistons, who are just diabolically bad at basketball, right? and he's saying, you know, like, I've kind of gotten over the wins and the losses, right? Because I mean, I don't know what they are, 3-25 or something, right?
Something like horrible record. It's not great.
And it can't be fun to be in that locker room and losing over and over again. And a little bit like Wembanyama at the Spurs, same thing, right? Mm-hmm. They've zoomed out to where the win-loss bracket is less important. And they're so much more driven on getting better and being fundamentally sound, that the, you know, the wins and the losses will, that's just a byproduct of what you do behind and in the background. And I definitely had to get burnt by that to learn that for sure. And, you know, if I hang on, you know, I might wait another year and a half and try and make another Walker Cup team. I don't know. But you know, it's just every time you go have an experience like that, you know, you put another weapon in your armory, you know, and if you can be as, you know, as mentally sound as you possibly can, you're going to come out on top in particularly the high pressure, high stress situations. So yeah, that's been a big learning curve for me this last year.
Amazing. So what were some of the things that you carried over from Coach White, from Seton Hall, now playing as an amateur here, going across the world, playing different, tournaments across the world, as you mentioned a couple before. So what were some of the things that you learned?
Coach White would be the first person to tell you that his golfing knowledge wasn't massively deep, but he would, you know, he was relentlessly committed, that guy, to us. And when you see someone who's like that driven and that committed and that ready to, you know, at the drop of a hat, be where he needs to be and do what he needs to do, it really makes you check yourself. Cause it's like, if you can, you know, if you're that willing and you have, you know, you have all of these people, it's like, gratitude was definitely a big thing from Coach White. Like he, you know, he taught, I mean, the military background definitely helps with that. The discipline and the integrity was central to his principles and his philosophies. And he definitely passed some of that on. A good little story to kind of sum that up. So I played great at an event in my freshman year in Florida. And after the second round, I was leading the event, and I don't think I'd made any bogeys or I'd dropped next to no shots. And I three putt the last hole from nowhere, right? Just a rush of blood to the head, terrible. And because we were leading, we were the last group to come in. So there was a fair few guys standing around the greens, parents, members of the club that we were playing. And I took my ball out of the hole and I threw it straight into the lake next to the green, right? That, very common thing. You mm-hmm. flick on the PGA Tour, you'll see them do it all the time, right? But I was, Coach White pulled me to the side, and you know, it was like he had, it was like, you know, I'd played some ridiculously good golf for two rounds, and it was like none of it had even happened. Like it was irrelevant. He was going to make a point of teaching me a lesson about having a bit of awareness and gratitude mm-hmm. and seeing yourself through other people's eyes. You know, that was way more important to him than talking about the three putt or talking about the golf that I'd played or you know, getting ready for tomorrow. Like that was second to his problem that he took. And what he loved so much, and this is testament to most Coach White teams, is that before he even had the chance to pull me to the side and have a word, I was barraged by the seniors and the juniors on the team for what I'd done. Right. So it's like he's instilled that in them so early that he didn't even have to do anything. Like I already felt terrible about what I'd done just on how my teammates had spoken to me. So then when he pulls me to the side, it's like we didn't get into a giant, great, big screaming match or anything like that. It was just like, because he knew that most of that disciplining had already been done by the guys. You know, the seniors and we had a grad assistant coach, Kevin O'Brien, at that point, and he said something, and then, you know, Gen and Chris had said something, and Chalky had said something, and it was like, you know, when you hear it from that many significant people to you, it's like it you know, the message hits home. And he, you know, pulled me to the side and we had this conversation. And then when we then got back to the hotel, then we started, you know, locked back in for the golf, and it was what we're going to do tomorrow and this, that, and the other. But I think that's really, you know, he was a great golf coach, but he was a better person. And I think that's, you know, even in, you know, we had some terrible defeats and we had some amazing successes, and he was pretty consistent amongst most of them. You know, he would be just as annoyed as we were if we played bad or, you know, we choked away a lead, anything like that. But it was always, you know, still treat everybody with the respect that they deserve. And, you know, definitely, I think, you know, I saw him do some, you know, amazingly selfless things. Like the one story I always tell people, we were driving through, I think it was Virginia or West Virginia. And we stopped to get some lunch, and we're all standing there in the line. And there's a serviceman who's up with, I think he was with his child, I forget, but there was a serviceman up ordering, and Coach White, completely silently, you know, just went over, paid for his food, and just walked back. And there was no, like, you know, there was no like selfies being taken or look at what I did, look at me, look at this. Like he just did it quietly, unassumingly, you know, didn't stick it in anybody's face. Like I think that sort of carries a lot more weight for me than any skill that he taught me on the golf course, or how to control my emotions or how to breathe right or not grip it too tight. Like that's all, you know, that's all sport stuff. Sports just sport. But the lessons that I learned from him, certainly in that aspect, were something I'll never ever forget and will carry forward with me for a long, long, long time.
Amazing. Amazing stories there about Coach White there. So last one before we start wrapping up about your amateur career is has there been a favorite place that you've gotten to play during your amateur career here that you're gonna look back at and like, wow, that was an amazing tournament for me, and that's something I'm never gonna forget?
Yeah, I think the Scottish Am last year. So it was at Royal Dornoch. And, you know, the heartbreak of finishing second, like that'll fix itself over time, you know. Silver medals are one of those things, I think they grow on you, right? Because initially you hate them, and then eventually you look back and say, actually, you know what, I did well. But that place is really special. So the associate head coach when I was at Seton Hall was Ian Lagowitz. Mm-hmm. Who I'm not sure if you guys have met, but he has a place in Dornoch. And his son, who passed on the year before I got to Seton Hall, has a bench underneath the big Royal Dornoch Golf Club sign. And I went up and stayed with Ian and his wife, and went, you know, a few weeks before and got some preparation in and spent some time with him, and then went back, and he, you know, he put me and my family up in his house, and you know, it just like the most, it was such a special week, and like it almost felt like everything was in place for me to win, and for it not to come through, and you know, the conversation that I had with Ian after everything was done, and was, you know, it was so special to me, and something that I'll kind of hold with me forever. And to represent him and, you know, his son and all of the American members at Royal Dornoch was really, really, it was a massive honor for me. And, you know, he's got so many friends at that club, and I had so many people come up and, you know, speak to me on account of him. I think is, you know, you can't pay anybody a higher compliment than that. And also that golf course is absolutely unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Everything aside, the golf course is wonderful.
But yeah, that was a really special week. I had my dad there, and I had Chalky there caddying for me, and didn't win, but played great and had so many special memories. And definitely one that I'll hold with me forever. And I look forward to going back. I'm sure I will. Can't avoid that place again. It was too good. It's just so far north. Far north. Like you drive, you get over the border, and you're like, oh, there's Edinburgh, and there's Glasgow, and there's Stirling. And then you're like, oh, well, it can't be far away. You know, Scotland's not too big. Currently, you've got another 4 hours of driving to do. Oh, my goodness. But yeah, really special place. Really, really special place.
Awesome. Amazing. And you've offered a bunch of advice so far throughout this episode, and we're going to now go into advice to a pirate. So being a winner of a team title, which, when you look back at it, there was a 3-year stretch where you guys won a championship. Softball won last year. The year before was men's soccer, and it was kind of a little bit of a streak there going. So what advice would you give to any Seton Hall team trying to achieve that team title for their first time in a very long time, or to go back to back like softball did, or even your team in golf trying to get back to the top of the mountain?
Yeah, I think you got to play harder for the guy next to you than you do for yourself. And, you know, that's applicable in so many team sports. And if you want it more for the guy next to you than you do for yourself, you'll make all the sacrifices that you need to, and you'll do all the hard things, and you won't cut any corners, and you know, because you want to do a good job on their behalf. And I think that when I look back at our championship team and other teams that I was on too, you know, the success comes when you want to play for the guy who's next year. And you know, I've played a little bit for the Scotland team after, and we won the European team title this year, and that was the same thing. Like the group was so close and so, you know, such good friends, and knew so much about one. You know, we had a pair of brothers on the team, so obviously that helps. And then of the other six guys, like five of them have known each other since they're 12 years old, have been through everything together, and fight for each other so hard that it's like no one was going to stop us. No one was going to get in the way of us. And it felt much like that at the Big East Championship too, you know. So, you know, caring about people is important. And caring about your teammates is important. And, you know, everybody plays their best sport and plays their best stuff when they're in the right headspace. And if you have the power to put somebody into that into that place where they can really get into their zone. And it's different for every single person that you come across. There is no one set, you know, there is no one set structure that's going to make every athlete you put through it play well. That's why when you look at like the greatest coaches, you know, in sport, they're so unbelievably good at man management, right? And being able to treat everybody slightly differently, but treat everybody fairly. And I think that balance is really difficult to find. But if you want the best for your teammates, then the best will come for you too.
That's awesome, man. That's really, really cool. And I think you just said it. It's like you're a human being before you're an athlete.
Yeah.
And I think JT talked about it, and a lot of the coaches talked about it, like how we were just saying, like, it's learning how to talk to each player differently and get the same message across. And every player is going to take it differently. But the fact is that you're pulling for the guy next to you. And if you're looking at them like, hey, they're working really hard, I got to do the same thing. That competitiveness that you were saying before, like, I'm kind of competing against him, making him better, he making me better. And it seems like you're so self-aware of all of this in the golf and the mental game, and kind of understanding like what makes people tick. And it's not only just like the athletes, it's kind of the human savvy inside of them. So that's really, really cool. And thanks again for sharing all this. I think this is our last section here, right?
Yeah, right, walk the plank. Yeah, walk the plank. Okay. So these are quicker based questions here. Obviously, if you have an explanation to any of them, please feel free to explain yourself with them. So first things first, favorite on the course snack.
Banana. Keep it simple.
Very simple.
Don't need to overcomplicate that one.
Justin, it'll be energy balls next year. Just FYI.
Yeah.
You're gonna have to ship those. That might be a pricey shipping label for you there, Jonathan.
Yeah.
I'll have to work out an NIL deal with someone. To get don't worry.
Just send them over. Well, my friend George playing on the golf team. Just send them over with him. You know, we live 10 minutes down the road. Perfect.
Perfect. There you go. Favorite course that you've ever played on?
Yeah, Royal Dornoch. Yeah, Royal Dornoch.
No doubt.
It's got that beautiful blend of American conditioning and British like classic links design. It's the best hybrid that I've ever come across. It's
a lot of fun,
and it's just such a special place. Like, you know, we could talk for another hour just about that place. So we'll move on.
Hardest course you've ever had to play at?
So this is great. So they took us. One time we were playing a tournament down in Georgetown, and Coach White and Coach Lagowitz did a little research around the local area to see if there would be anywhere fun to go and play, and so they took us to a place called Tot Hill, which is the seventh hardest golf course in America. And it was just nuts. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, the designer must have been on a wild ride when they were laying this thing into the land. Honestly, some of the craziest holes, and, you know, just, it was like a crazy golf course, but that was 7,500 yards long. You know, it was so fun. It was really, really awesome, but so hard. It really beat the whole team up. I'm not sure if it was actually a great thing to go and play a tournament the next day, but we had a lot of fun.
Oh, amazing. Favorite playing partner?
Ooh, that's hard.
I know you said you like to play by yourself. Besides yourself and me, myself, yeah, and I, who else we got?
Yeah. Me and my critical thoughts. I think I would go for, I'll go for Andres. We've played so much golf together, and you know, we've had some proper, like, gets nasty, but, you know, we shake hands at the end, and, you know, the friendship continues. But yeah, we make each other better, the two of us. So I'll go for Andres.
Awesome. Amazing. Favorite post match meal?
I'll go for like a carbonara pasta.
Fantastic. Now, we asked Coach Harper this last week or 2 weeks ago, but are you a music guy on the golf course, or are you on your own thoughts? I know I prefaced it with him, with Coach Harper, because on PGA Radio, it was something that was brought up quite often about whether to have music on the golf course or not. So are you a music guy on the golf course?
If I'm playing alone, I am, yeah. I'll have the headphones in. And if I'm doing like block practice, like just scrape and hit, then I'll have the music in. And then if I'm doing anything like performance based, then I'll keep the headphones out. But yeah, I would have said objectively, yes, I am. I'm all for music on the golf course. Keeps it fun.
Yeah.
Usually it's good to have music on because you can always hear people cussing from a couple holes over and they just shank one in the bush. So
the biggest mentor that you've had during either your college career, your amateur career, or both?
That's hard.
The walk the plank questions are sometimes the hardest ones, yeah. as Kevin, we found out.
I'll keep it in the Seton Hall family. Kevin O'Brien has been really, really good to me. He's watched out for me, and you know, he checks in when things are good and he checks in when things are bad. And I think you find in sport that you always have a group of people who you only get a message from when things go well. And I think makes you value the people who send you a message when things aren't going well that much more. But he's been great at guiding me through, you know, this like next step and where to go. And you know, I confide in him when I have problems, and he's a really knowledgeable guy in the golf game as well. So he's been really key for me, and will be going forwards as well.
Amazing. And last one for me, in one word, describe your playing style.
Intelligent.
Why intelligent?
Because I started playing golf pretty late. I didn't start till I was like 14. So I know that I am tens of thousands of reps behind most of the guys who I'm playing against. So I have to beat them with my head more often than I do with my skill, but I'm pretty explosive. So I got a lot of speed. I'd like to think it's intelligent, but quite often it's just power that gets me by. I'll go intelligent. I like to think I play a pretty smart game, and you know, there's an unbelievable amount of statistics out there in the golf game, and if you can make sense of even half of them, it will help you. So yeah.
Amazing.
Awesome. Well, cool. Gregor, thank you so much for being on. We reached out to our recent golf guest, the coach JT Harper, and he nicknamed you the closer. So I was going to think about that. I'm not sure if he nicknamed you or that's nickname that came
that was,
about.
It was Andres who nicknamed me. So we won a big tournament down in South Carolina at the end of fall. And then we opened up with like a couple more wins. But the second win, the next two wins, I had the best round in the field on the final day. So like made a big move for us. And Andres kind of just threw it out there. He was like, oh, well, you're now the closer. So like you're going to have to live up to this. You're going to have to live up to this, this new personality that you have. And going into the final round at the Big East, I remember sitting with Angus and Wen and Andres before the final round, and I said, just go out and don't do anything too silly, like don't you worry, because the closer will get it done. And we were at the place because I was the last one to come in, and for it to happen the way it did was just mental. It was one of the most insane experiences I've ever had. I've actually got on my ring, I've got the closer. So like where everyone has their name, I've got the closer.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Man. So yeah, it was really cool.
Well, man, Gregor, thank you so much for coming on. JT, when we were talking to him, spoke so highly of you. He said you and Dre are two of the best leaders that he's ever had. And he couldn't say enough high things about you. And I think anyone would be the same way, Justin, myself, and anyone else in the golf world, Seton Hall.
Thanks,
thank you for what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing. We're rooting you on. It's so cool to see all the things you're doing. Representing Seton Hall so well and yourself so well. So, man, thank you again for coming on. Spending about an hour, over an hour with us chatting, giving a place and everything. So.
No, I enjoyed it. Thanks, guys. And best of luck for your seasons. I guess it's probably getting going pretty soon for you, is it, Justin?
Yeah, we are going to wrap up at the end of February. Big East is at the end of February. And then we have there's a meet in March called CSCAAs, which is like the NIT of swimming. So that's the that's the goal. That's the goal to get to there. And I know Luders is starting up, and we'll be following him very closely. Nice, so again, thank you for coming on. That's another alumni spotlight episode we've done here with Pirates Overboard. We can't do. We're going to do a couple more here, but as we get closer to people coming back onto campus, we're going to have some more current athletes on the show, and we can't wait to really tell them about their stories as we get some more spring athletes in, including yourself, Jonathan. Yeah. So get ready. Get ready. We got some walk the plane questions for you, buddy. They come. So until next time, we'll talk to you later.